It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we take a look at the issue of domestic violence and discuss the ongoing fallout from the video of NFL player Ray Rice assaulting his then-fiancé released yesterday.
First, it's our Wisconsin Authors segment where we feature writers from around the state.
Emily Page is 13 years old and the author of The Spirit Realm Trilogy, a fantasy series featuring The Spirit Realm and The Spirit's Shadow, both books that she completed earlier this year.
Right now, she's working on the third installment in the trilogy called The Spirit War, which she hopes to complete while also staying on top of her eighth grade homework and school activities. She joins us now from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, how old were you when you got this idea of the core of the story for Spirit Realm?
I think I was maybe about 12. It was the summer before I started sixth grade, and I guess I kind of just came up with it as I rode in the car. It was just pretty normal.
And this is a place where souls sounds like they get kidnapped at death. Tell us about what Spirit Realm is.
The Spirit Realm is, like you said, a place where souls have been kidnapped from their bodies after death. And in the story, the souls are collected through this paneling system that the Samoxti, the people who created the Spirit Realm, put into the ground like 1,000 years ago to collect the souls. So, but the souls are not well kept. They're overpopulation of souls, and it's really critical that we get the main characters, Alicia and Amira, get the souls to a better afterlife.
And that's also really fascinating. So you've got these two main characters, I think they're twins, Alicia and Amira, and they find out that they're this sort of a powerful being. They can do almost anything. Tell us about them.
Alicia and Amira are these twin sisters, and they... And one is more skilled in dark magic, and she'd be better suited to the people who created the Spirit Realm, who are also skilled in dark magic. And Alicia is kind of more gentle, and she's better suited to light magic, like the people who are fighting against the people who created the Spirit Realm. And they are, and they're like best friends, but they kind of have this block in between them when they find out what their powers would be meant for.
And you said they're kind of like, you know, flip sides of yourself, these two girls. How so?
Alicia is kind of this really virtuous and selfless character who I really hope I would be in that situation. And Amira is, she's just a normal girl. She doesn't think she's very special, but she's strong and she's selfless in her own way. And Alicia is kind of who I hoped would represent who I hope to be. And Amira is closer to who I really am because she's just normal. I mean, she likes to draw. She's a good portrayal of just a 15-year-old girl.
Hmm. It's so interesting because here you are, you're in eighth grade, and you've written two books already. Sounds like the third one is about to be done or is nearing completion as well. How did you ever get it together as someone who's got schoolwork and friendships to juggle, chores, needing extra sleep as a teenager? How did you find time to write books?
I've always really enjoyed writing, and I kind of just treated the Spirit Realm as just a story that I wrote in my free time. And I did a lot of writing over the summer when like we had nothing to do. We'd just sit around the house and I'd just write my story. And so I got a lot of writing done during that time, during the summers, and also my school has this time during the day where we can just do homework, and I do a lot of homework then. So I kind of found the time, and my friends are also writers, so sometimes we just sit and write together, and it'd be pretty fun.
This is what teenagers are like. They sit around and write novels now. I need to catch up. Or is this just your group of friends?
I think it's just us. I don't know, but I hope not.
Yeah.
But my friends and I all really like to write.
It sounds okay to me. So you're in a supportive group. What did your parents think about this, that their daughter was writing a novel, a trilogy?
My parents have always really supported me in everything. And they really liked the fact that I like to write. And when I sent it in, they said not to get my hopes up too high, but at the same time, they were really excited for me.
Now, I've got a copy of it here, and you researched the publishing, the marketing, all of that. How did you end up getting it published? Did you do it yourself, or did you find a publisher?
I found a publisher who would accept it, and Solstice Publishing, and they basically did a lot of it. They gave me an editor, and they gave me a cover, and they talked me through a lot of it because I was pretty new to this, obviously, and they've been very good to me. They've done a lot of it for me.
Well, what did you learn about how to submit a book? Because this is stuff that a lot of grown-up authors would like to know, how to write a book and get it published. What advice do you have?
There is this book that I got at the library called Writer's Market, and it's this, like, 1,000-page block, and it teaches you how to do a lot of the writing, like how to submit it to publishers, like where you find it and you send in a manuscript through email or through the mail. And it told you how to write, like, a cover letter, like how to basically sell your book to them, and that was very helpful. So if you're trying to sell a book, I'd recommend you read that.
Let's move on to your name. Emily Page, I gather, is not your real name. You chose a pen name. How come?
First, because of security reasons, because I'm 13 years old. I don't really want someone to know everything about me because they know my real name. But I also wanted to, I've always enjoyed making up names because, you know, that's why I write. I really want to write for a long time, and I didn't want to have to worry about changing my author name when I got married or something like that. So I came up with a fake last name.
Wow, so you're really thinking down the road. Is that where you see yourself, say, I don't know, 10 years down the road? Do you want to be writing books for a living?
Yes, I do. I hope to get better.
What kind of feedback have you gotten so far?
I'm mostly positive. There's a lot of really good reviews, mostly from my family members on Amazon. And my sister says that she likes the second book, The Spirit Shadow, better than the first one because the writing is better. So it's been mostly positive, but like when my sister said that, I'm happy she was honest with me.
So do you feel like you're evolving as it goes along, that people who read them books 1 through 3 will realize, yeah, here's Emily just starting out, but here she is really getting her footing?
Definitely. I feel like I've gotten a lot better from the first book to the third book.
Wow. Well, it's fantastic, and I'm excited for you. What do your teachers say? Are you kind of the star when you walk down the halls?
I actually recently moved, and with the new school year starting, a lot of my teachers don't really know. But back in my old school, my English teacher was, like, ecstatic, and she was so excited. A lot of people were like, hey, didn't you write a book? So,
yeah, you need to get a T-shirt that says, I'm Emily Page, I wrote a trilogy. So you can get the word out at your new school.
Yeah.
Well, it's fantastic. Thank you so much, and I look forward to reading more of them. Emily, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
We've been speaking to Emily Page, the author of the Spirit Realm trilogy, featuring The Spirit Realm, The Spirit Shadow, and the upcoming The Spirit War. Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice was released by his team and suspended indefinitely by the NFL on Monday after a video surfaced showing the player punching his then-fiancée and knocking her unconscious in an elevator.
It's a high-profile case that's shining the spotlight on the issue of domestic violence.
Joining us now is Christopher Mollering. He's the director of the Domestic Violence and Women's Rights Clinic at the University of Buffalo Law School. Christopher, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
First off, Christopher, what was your reaction when this story broke with this video yesterday?
Well, I was happy to see the NFL taking a stronger stance. I think there was a lot of criticism from a lot of sources of the NFL's original suspension of Ray Rice of only 2 games. I don't know how much information the NFL had when they made that initial decision, but in light of the new video, it seems appropriate, both the NFL suspension and the Ravens' termination of Ray Rice's contract.
Have you watched the video?
I have.
What did you think?
It's disturbing, and I think for a lot of people who may not be familiar with domestic violence, I think it was a real wake-up call. It's a graphic video.
I had no intention of watching it, and then a friend told me I really should see it to care about it, and I did, and I'm still kind of recovering from seeing it. It's about 3 minutes and 34 seconds long, something like that, but it feels like forever watching her get up from the ground. What do you think this says, this video, to women watching who are victims of domestic violence, and the fact that this is so public?
Well, I hope that the fact that this is such a high profile case will encourage women maybe who were hesitant to speak up or who felt muzzled by the situation in which they find themselves just to seek help to tell someone else about what they're going through to take their case to the court or to an advocate or to a friend. I hope that this incident, will have that positive outcome of encouraging women to break their silence, because this is an issue that affects 1 in 4 American women at some point in their lifetime are going to be victims of domestic violence, and so it's a problem that needs a lot more of a spotlight shown on it.
Is there a mixed message going on? This morning we have the wife of Ray Rice saying, this feels like a nightmare. We're working through it. We both regret it. I don't know, sort of conciliatory language and sort of brushing off, minimizing the incident. Is that undoing some of the good it could do to draw attention and consciousness about domestic violence?
I read his wife's comments, and one of the things I sort of the first thing I thought when Roger Goodell announced the new NFL policy was, good, the NFL is taking a much stronger stance on an issue where they need to have leadership. And my second thought was, what are going to be the unintended consequences of this policy? And I think we're seeing that with Jhené Rice. One of those unintended consequences, I think, is that in a situation like the NFL, where there is so much money involved, a suspension or a lifetime ban sees not only the player, but his family and other people that may benefit from his lucrative salary. All of them stand to lose a lot of money. And so I think, one of the consequences that we could see is that actually victims might be less inclined to come forward, because there's going to be increased pressure on them, whether it's because they're considering their own families and their children who are supported by the NFL salary, or whether that pressure is coming from the player, or whether it's coming from the group of people around him who stand to benefit from his salary. There could actually be increased pressure on victims of domestic violence not to come forward because of the amount of money that we're talking about being lost if a player is suspended or banned. So I think that might be one of the things that we're seeing here in the case of Ray Rice's wife, is that those are the things that she is thinking about, the loss of the money for her and for her family. And I do think that it's problematic, it's something that I think you see in a lot of domestic violence situations are women sort of brushing it off or making apologies or making excuses for behavior that is really unacceptable under any circumstances.
Going back to the NFL, do you think that now that they've started to take some steps toughening their stance against domestic violence, that they need to look at the policy and consider financial implications too, and think about more sophisticated or nuanced ways to handle this when it happens, so it's not a blanket punishment, but you take a look at exactly who is being punished.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to see how the new policy plays out, because the way that I read Roger Goodell's statement is that that there are potential that he set down a 6-game suspension for the first offense, a lifetime ban for the second offense, but that there are potential enhancements if certain things happen, like if the victim is pregnant, and there are also certain types of situations in which that penalty might be reduced, and he didn't really outline what those might be, but it'll be interesting to see if the NFL is able to to implement this policy in a way that really takes into account the individual situations rather than treating them all alike, because these situations are not all alike. But I do think that I was happy to see that the NFL took a very strong stance after the initial Ray Rice suspension, because the NFL needs to take a leadership role in this area.
Now, for some women, well, I'm thinking about Janae this morning, sort of writing that she was sorry about the role that she had played the night of the incident. That was on May 23rd, and she tweeted that this morning. It sort of creates a narrative that sometimes in relationships, there's a big mistake and someone gets punched, someone punches, but you can put it behind you and move forward. Is that the case ever? Do you see that, where someone in a relationship gets abused, but it's a one-off and they just move forward and learn from it? Does that happen, or is that a fantasy?
Well, I mean, I think it's... I don't think it would be accurate to say that every instance of violence within a relationship is indicative of an abusive relationship. I think there are probably cases in which an incident of violence happens once, and the couple is able to move on from that, and there are no further incidents. So I don't want to make a blanket statement, but I think that that's generally not the case. I think generally when you see, and I don't know about Ray Rice's situation specifically, but I think in general when you see these incidents, when you see the violence, oftentimes that's just the tip of the iceberg. A lot of times there are a lot of other types of abuse that are already going on. A lot of times abusers will isolate their victims, will keep them from having social interactions with family, with friends, with other people. They could be controlling their finances and withholding money or controlling money. There can be ritual sort of humiliation of the victim, verbal humiliation. And there can be threats to injure not only the victim, but the victim's children or members of the family. So I think there's a lot of types of abuse that we don't necessarily see when we see that incidence of violence. So, I think we have to be, very careful about thinking about these situations as one-off situations, because a lot of times they're not. A lot of times there is a pattern mm-hmm. of abuse that you can see stretching back, even if that abuse isn't necessarily always or hasn't been to this point physical.
All right, I want to jump in and get a call in quickly here. Tina in La Crosse. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I guess I'm coming from an older perspective, and also having worked most of my life in the military, I saw the video, and he's a hard, muscular man, and she was a little fluff of nothing, but it wasn't for her lack of trying. I mean, she dove at him. He should not have hit her. He should have pulled his punch, because basically, he's stronger than her, but there seems to be a lot of toxic relationships where the woman bites, spits, kicks, punches. Just the fact that she can't punch and can't fight is the only reason he's not injured.
All right. Thank you for your thoughts, Tina. And we've got about 30 seconds or so for your response before we go to news, Christopher.
Sure. I think we have to be... we have to take a be careful in this instance, because the simple fact that a woman you know, is standing up to a potential abuser does not make that abuse less real or less of a problem. So, like I said, I don't know the specifics of Ray and Janae Rice's situation, whether there is a history there or whether this might have been a one-off situation. But I think that the simple fact that we saw his wife engage in some kind of a physical alteration should not take the burden off of him not to have hit her and not to to have left the situation.
Talking with Christopher Mollering about the ongoing Ray Rice story and the issue of domestic violence in the United States.
You can join in with your reaction to this story and your thoughts on whether we're putting enough emphasis on fighting domestic violence in the U.S. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation after the news.
We're talking about domestic violence in the United States following the fallout from the recently released video that shows football player Ray Rice punching and knocking out his then-fiancé in an elevator. Our guest is Christopher Mollering, director of the Domestic Violence and Women's Rights Clinic at the University of Buffalo Law School.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. As a society, are we taking domestic violence seriously? What more should we be doing to prevent it? How would you like to see the NFL or other high-profile organizations step up and take the lead on the issue of domestic violence? You can call in at 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, we go to our phone lines now. We've got Sharon with us from Wautoma. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there. As hard as he hit her, and I put my DVR on real slow, I mean, he cold-cocked her. She should either have a busted jaw or a broken cheekbone. And if he hit her like that once, he's been hitting her for a while. And why she married him? God knows. Maybe she was in it for the money, but she better get out real fast before he kills her. I mean, that was ridiculous. He hit her so hard, she went flying.
Thank you. Thank you for calling, Sharon. You're depicting what is a very graphic and upsetting video. Maybe we can take from that call, Christopher, why she married him. I mean, it's a complicated thing, but can you speak to a little bit what happens in relationships like that when the victim stays with the abuser?
Sure. I think that's there's a very common misconception in the general population about women who stay with their abusers, and that, you know, that this perhaps is indicative of, you know, some sort of masochistic tendencies, or it must not be that bad if the woman won't leave. And that's a real problem when we're talking about this area, because there are all kinds of reasons why someone might stay in this kind of relationship. The kind of dynamic that you have, you know, is generally that the abuser tends to be generally fairly charismatic. And initially, these relationships don't usually start out as abusive. That usually happens later in the relationship. So, you know, some of the reasons why a woman might stay in an abusive relationship is that, you know, she loves the person, even despite the abuse. There could be issues of you know, financial support. You know, if the woman doesn't have job skills or a job because the abuser has been isolating her, has been controlling her finances, the act of leaving can be an expensive one if she doesn't have any financial resources. There could be threats against her, against her family, against her children. A lot of times, you know, when these cases go to court, abusers will seek to use the court system in the venue of seeking custody as a way of lashing back out against the victim. So there's all kinds of reasons why someone might stay in one of these relationships that has nothing to do with, you know, with the fact that they, like it, or that they're, you know, masochistic or anything like that. There's a lot of legitimate reasons, and I think that's not always well conveyed when we're thinking about these issues and talking about these issues.
And we go next to Nick, joining us in Greenfield. Hi, Nick.
Yeah, hi there. I appreciate your guest. He is talking about one of the important things, and I want to say three things. First of all, I was lucky as a boy growing up. I had a dad that taught me two things. He said, one, he says, a man is less than a man if he has to hit a woman. I started hearing that when I was about 9, 10 years old. And the second thing he taught me, he says, son, he says, you're going to meet women that are smarter than you. And you're a pretty smart kid, but there are women out there that are smarter than you. Don't substitute your physical size and strength trying to offset their intelligence. So those are the two lessons that he taught me as I was growing up. But what I called to say was the NFL, in my opinion, went from a slap on the wrist, you know, 60 days probation, to hanging. What happened to the 6-game suspension? Why didn't they go from 2 games to 6 games if he did it again? Then how?
Gotcha. Thanks, Nick, for your thoughts there. And, you know, talking about the suspension there, and he's been released from his contract with the Ravens. But what do you think about the punishment fitting the crime? This is one aspect of domestic violence. We're talking about football here, and most domestic abuse cases happen outside the realm of pro sports. But if we look at this here, what do you think about the appropriateness, Christopher?
Yeah, so I did think that the initial 2-game suspension of Ray Rice was too lenient, and I think that was a very general consensus, not only in the field that studies this stuff, but in the general public. I thought that the 6-game suspension for a first offense and a lifetime ban for a second offense that Roger Goodell suggested in the letter he sent to the NFL owners, I thought was a much better policy. A much tougher policy, but also one that, you know, that recognized, you know, that sometimes and in some circumstances there can be mistakes and people deserve a second chance if they've made a single mistake. Whether or not this, this is an overreaction by the NFL, I think it's hard to say. The video is pretty barbaric. But the NFL, I think there is, an issue with that they need to consider about, they've put out this policy and now they have again changed their stance, as Nick mentioned. So, I think the Ravens' decision to terminate his contract is totally separate from that. They obviously have the right to make that decision or not. And I wonder if some of the severity of the NFL and the Ravens sanction is indicative of the fact that they don't believe that Ray Rice was fully truthful with them when this first happened. I know they're saying they didn't see the video until it was released by TMZ Sports, today or very recently, and so maybe the punishment is indicative of that fact that Ray Rice wasn't fully honest with the team and with the NFL about what really happened that night. And now we can see what really happened that night. So
we're talking about this out in the open right now because the video is out there, because he's a pro football player, but a lot of the time this isn't a part of our everyday conversation. How widespread is the problem of domestic violence in the United States?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Most of the time, these incidents are not happening to a high-profile person, and so we're not seeing them. But domestic violence affects 1 in 4 women in the United States, 25%. So if you think about your grandmother, your mother, your sister, your daughter, there's your 4 women right there. Not that this will happen in every family or to every person, but it doesn't take a lot to, if people think about all the women in their lives that they know, to find someone who's been affected by domestic violence. So, I hope that this incident will cause more people to talk about this issue, to think about this issue, and that it'll let, give victims the ability to talk about these kind of things with friends, with family, with advocates. But it's definitely an issue that is much more widespread than I think we would like to admit, and it's an issue that really deserves a lot more attention than I think it gets on a regular basis.
And Christopher, in our last minute, what do you want victims to know about how to get help if they find themselves in a situation that might be like this?
Well, you know, there are increasingly good resources available across the country. There are organizations that will provide a one-stop shop for victims of domestic violence. So they'll help them with alternative housing arrangements, with beginning court proceedings, with child care. So I think the key thing for victims to know is that there are those resources out there, and they, you know, when they are able to work up the courage to leave a toxic relationship, even if that takes several times for them to be able to make that final break from a dangerous and toxic relationship, that there are resources out there. There are people who are there looking to help victims of domestic violence. And so these victims of domestic violence are not alone. And they should, I hope that that's what they take away from this, is that there are a lot of people that that want to provide help. And so, you know, I hope that those victims will take this opportunity to reach out and utilize those resources.
Christopher, thanks a lot for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica.
That was Christopher Mollering, director of the Domestic Violence and Women's Rights Clinic at the University at Buffalo Law School.
Right now it's time for Teach Me What You Know. Today we're looking at one of the times in life when communication can matter the most, when we're talking with our doctor. It's important for patients and doctors to understand each other and form a plan of treatment, both when we're really sick and even if we're just in for a minor complaint.
Dr. Toby Campbell joins us now. He's an assistant professor of medicine and palliative care expert at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Dr. Campbell, thanks for coming up to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So it can be a difficult thing to talk to the doctor for some of us. Some people are intimidated. Sometimes people are embarrassed. Sometimes it's just hard to articulate what's going on. So as a doctor, what is the first thing that you want people to know about how to be effective when they're talking with you, with a doctor?
It's really important to me that you understand that this is your time, that this communication that we are having is a two-way street, and that it's a partnership. I want a partner in this conversation, and I want a partner in this endeavor. So come to the visit ready to be honest, ready to be open, ready to play a part in the discussion.
On TV, sometimes the patient gives us tiny detail that solves the whole case, and it's Mongolian fungus or something like that. But should we include every little detail? How do we prioritize what we tell you, the doctor?
Well, everybody comes to the visit with a different set of needs, and to a degree, I think it's important to understand what the doctor's life might be like. They may be seeing someone with Mongolian fungus in the morning and someone with Ghanaian fungus in the afternoon and the South African fungus to wind up the day. We have no idea. The difficulty, though, is identifying which individual has which problem. So yes, there are the sort of medical mysteries, but to a larger degree, the patient-doctor relationship is about what's going on with you. So if you, I think I would encourage people to prepare for the visit. So what is most important to you today? Again, this is your time. What's most important? What are the three or four most important items for you? And stick to the point. Be prepared to talk about what symptoms you have. You might want to create a list of the things that are going on that you've noticed, because in the moment it can be hard to remember or sometimes forget. And I think you should expect from your doctor the expertise necessary to put together those pieces of information you're providing to come up with the conclusion about Mongolian or Ghanaian fungus, neither of which I think exists.
I was just going to ask if that actually exists, if it should be something I should be concerned about, since you both seem to know so much about it. Well, that's a relief.
Well, it was a hypothetical.
I want to ask you, what about times when someone doesn't feel heard? I'm guessing it's usually going to be the patient, the doctor. I don't know if they may not be aware of that, but I've had conversations with people where they say, I really don't feel like my doctor is hearing me. I don't think I'm getting what I'm trying to say across. Is it a good time then to look for another doctor, or is there a way to kind of tweak that relationship?
Well, to start with, I don't think it's ever a bad idea to ask yourself the question, is this the right relationship for me? Having said that, so much time on both your part and the doctor's part goes into building that relationship at the beginning. So before abandoning the relationship, I would first encourage people to think about ways in which they might address that problem that they're seeing. So a few questions to consider. Perhaps you might say something like, I realize you're very busy, but I need to discuss this issue with you further. do we need another appointment time, or could we discuss it more today? Another example, I'm concerned that we aren't communicating well. Here's why. You know, as a physician, I would really respond to that, right? I mean, to me, that would be a flag that would distinguish that visit from another one that I'd had during the day, and I honestly would spend some extra time coming to grips with it. That wouldn't be okay with me.
So you'd be okay hearing that. You wouldn't take it, you know, badly and look askance at the patient.
Absolutely not. Now, I will say that, again, if we are on the same page and we have prioritized our time, I understood, realize that doctors often have agendas. The agendas should be related to what the patient brings to the visit, but make sure it's your time. So if you know what three or four issues are pressing and the doctor has one or two that are pressing, we ought to be able to cover most of those. If these issues and these concerns are coming up at the very end of a visit that's already perhaps gone long, I might not have as much time to honestly devote to answering that question, and I might need to say, I think we will have to schedule another appointment for that. But it's really important to voice those concerns. I mean, I would want to address those. I would want to hear that.
We've been focusing on the diagnosis side so far. I know it's a concern in the medical community that patients comply. They go with the treatment plan and understand it. So as a patient, how do you make sure you come out of the office knowing, you know, this medication had this off and this lifestyle change, whatever the treatment might be?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would encourage people to be strong advocates for themselves, to potentially not come to a visit alone. As an oncologist and a palliative care doctor, essentially everyone that I see is very, very sick, very ill. And it's hard for me to remember the last person I saw by themselves. So frequently there are multiple family members there taking notes. It is a common occurrence at least several times a day for people to audio record the conversation. Completely fine. I like it when people ask me if that's okay, but I always say yes. I mean, I want you to remember what happened during this visit. And I want to be giving good advice, and it is honestly no added pressure to make sure that we're communicating effectively. So advocate for yourself, bring a note taker, take notes yourself, audio record. All are, I think, effective ways at remembering what happened during that visit.
So to go with what you were talking about here, palliative care, end-of-life issues, people who are very sick sometimes, people may be in that hospital room, the doctor's bustling in and out. How can family members make sure that the patient is getting what they need when that patient is no longer able really to speak for themselves anymore?
Well, this is another great point. So I just very recently was given a grant, a career development award from a group called the Cambia Foundation. And the part of my study is asking that very question, actually. So how do we best interact with people who are facing a serious illness? They may or may not be able to participate fully in that discussion. How do we make sure that they are getting the information that they need to make good decisions that are in line with their preferences? And, you know, there are ways. I think some of them are very similar. Having a good advocate with you, making sure that you're taking notes, keeping track of just what are the pressing issues for you so that you don't miss an opportunity. Particularly in the hospital, it can be difficult or even impossible to predict exactly when it is that a team's going to be coming, that a doctor will be coming to the room. Let me say, I don't think people advocate for themselves enough to say, my family's going to be here between 3 and 5 o'clock. Would it be possible for the doctor to come during that window? The answer is almost always yes, but we need to know that. Again, advocating for yourself is fine, is a good idea. It's your time. It's your body. We should hear from you.
I wonder about, since we're focusing on communication, what about situations where we've got somebody who, you know, English isn't their first language, say? How can they make sure they have a translator there if need be to make sure that you're getting past that communication barrier in a doctor's office?
Yeah, any barrier that you put. So whether someone's mind is fuzzy, you mentioned the case of someone who's confused earlier, or whether there's a language barrier or any number of barriers that get in the way of the communication, I think just increases the level of difficulty and increases the necessity to be honest, be open, and be clear on just what the most pressing issues are. I think where we really start to fall apart in those encounters in particular is when we get distracted by some side story that perhaps isn't relevant. And I think when when patients and families have prepared and they know what the issues are that are important to them, you're less likely to get taken off task. And to be honest, sometimes it's certainly the doctors that may take us off task, you know, and end up, you know, we end up talking about your last vacation, which is a pleasant conversation, but perhaps not the best use of your time. And, you know, cultural differences and language differences are an important thing and certainly something that doctors need to think about. I don't think there are any easy answers for that one, to be honest. It's something that all of us need to pay attention to because it certainly increases the difficulty.
You've given us some examples of things that patients can say to doctors that will make it known that they really need their voices heard. They can say, I don't feel I'm communicating with you, you know, let's really zero in on this. Some other examples, you worded them more eloquently than I did. But are there things that we should know that might rub a doctor the wrong way, a way that to communicate that's almost always ineffective?
Sure. You know, I had the benefit of knowing that I was coming on the radio, so I could think about what questions and how I wanted to phrase them, so they weren't just random. I think what is challenging for a doctor, and perhaps it might be insightful to, you know, step inside the doctor's shoes for a moment. It is a busy day. There are some real time constraints. We want to be on time. We're often not on time. Individuals are scheduled during these blocks of time, and they're all the same blocks. But someone may need more time than that. It might 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever the time allotted may not be the right time for that person. Someone else may only need 5. But on any given day, you can't really budget how these things are going to work. So I suppose what's challenging for me is things that important issues that come up at the very end of the visit. You know, it was important to you, but perhaps it's a sensitive subject. You know, it's something that was uncomfortable to talk about. And so, you know, it took a little while to warm up and to get there. And it comes out right at the end. I know it's important. You know it's important. And we both realize that we don't have the appropriate amount of time to deal with it. And then maybe we end up having to delay things until a subsequent visit, which is dissatisfying for both of us. So I think leading with that honest and open and understanding what it is that's important to you to talk about helps to alleviate the biggest frustration, which I think we have, which is big things coming up right at the end.
And just briefly, it's the digital age. Is it ever helpful to do a little pre-email like, hey, here are the things I want to make sure we hit in the limited time we have? Or is that something that doctors don't have the time to look at in the first place?
That's a really great question. I think every doctor has probably different ways in which they prefer to communicate, but increasingly electronic communication is a part of the routine. I personally kind of like to have a heads up about some of the big issues that are coming up. Now there are ways of communicating through the electronic medical record, which you can be more assured are secure. So I think if you've spent the time preparing for the visit, it's okay with me if I'm in on the agenda.
All right, Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That's Dr. Toby Campbell. He's an assistant professor of medicine and a palliative care expert in the UW Carbone Cancer Center.